Back to the Libya now with an update from the eastern Libyan city of Benghazi. The BBC's Kevin Connolly is there in Benghazi, and here he is speaking to Julian Marshall about whether or not there's any evidence of an official Libyan government presence left in Benghazi.
Not only is the answer to that no, Julian, but there's an extraordinary moment at the border port of Saloum, which is normally one of the world's most heavily militarized and guarded borders. All the formalities are still being done on the Egyptian side. They're processing migrant workers from China and Vietnam and Benin. But on the Libyan side, once you are through, the whole Libyan government apparatus there has simply melted away. There are one or two young men in partial uniform, but there is nothing really there to say that Libya is functioning at all on this eastern side of the country. We drove through, we carried our bags across down what is normally, as I say, a heavily guarded channel, picked up a driver and headed on into eastern Libya. And as I say, all of those border formalities, the customs, the processing, the military paperwork, none of that is there, and there is nobody there to run that side, at least, of Colonel Gaddafi's state. And that's the story that we've seen repeated as we have moved on through the country. We're just arriving now at an anti-government protest in Benghazi. There are perhaps, I don't know, a couple of thousand people here, I suppose. High above me on a lamppost is flying the old royalist flag of Libya, and below that, what I think is meant to be an effigy of Colonel Gaddafi is swinging in the Mediterranean wind.
And the protests taking place now in Benghazi, has that become, if you like, a sort of ritual? Because there are no longer any pro-Gaddafi forces in the city.
I think there is a sense in which the opposition believes that this all helps to keep up the pressure on Colonel Gaddafi's regime. It is a reminder to the watching world, and I see plenty of foreign TV crews arriving here now. It is a reminder to the watching world that this part of the country at least has slipped out of Colonel Gaddafi's control. They are not interested in any economic concessions I think he might be making. There are no signs of Gaddafi government forces here, of police or troops. A very large crowd gathered. And I suppose the most telling symbol of the balance here between protesters on the one hand and government on the other is, off to the right of me, just as we're arriving at the port, there's what looks like a tank with perhaps 20 or 30 young people sitting on there, two children or young men, I suppose, sitting astride the barrel of the gun. That looks as though it's been abandoned by Gaddafi government forces. And this part of Benghazi looks to be, in as much as it's being controlled by anybody, securely in anti-government hands.
And in Benghazi and in the towns and cities that you passed through on the way from the Egyptian border, was there a sense that life was returning to normal economic activity?
In truth, Julian, it was a very, very quiet drive. It's a day of prayer here, of course. We stopped at a mosque to allow one of our colleagues to pray. It's a sort of mosque and motorway service complex. It was almost deserted, but we've been able to buy coffee here and there. In one cafe we went into, there were a group of people watching the BBC Arabic service on the television trying to follow the news of the Libyan revolution. So there haven't, in truth, been an enormous number of people about. But to some extent, there have been signs of normal economic life. One sign of abnormality worth noting, I suppose, in one place there was a prison which looked abandoned. It looked as though it had been burned out. And the word from a local opposition order was, look, there's nobody to run it. And that prison, of course, would have been a symbol of the Gaddafi regime, a symbol of the colonel's control. And I suppose at the moment it's a symbol of the extent to which the colonel's control has melted away in and around Benghazi.
That was the BBC's Kevin Connolly speaking to Julian Marshall in Benghazi. And we want to turn to another democracy movement, this time in Ireland. Elections are being held there today. John Byrne joins us. He helped create a site called ballotbox.ie. It's open only to Irish expats who can't vote in the election, even if they're still citizens. John joins us from Toronto, where he emigrated to late last year. John, is there a longstanding law in Ireland that if you're not in country, you can't vote?
Yeah, that's right. Hi, Celeste. Ireland is one of the few countries in the EU and one of few democracies around the world where immigrants, once they leave the country, immediately they're disenfranchised. This would be in contrast, say, to Australia, where for 6 years after you leave a country you can vote. Canada, where I am at the moment, it's 5 years. Germany, it's 25 years. I know in the States, your citizens are allowed to vote from outside the country, but Ireland is one of the few countries where you can't do that. So this is something we were thinking about, myself and some of my Irish immigrant pals up here in Toronto. are all very interested in what happens in this general election. Many of us were forced out of Ireland for economic reasons because of the economic crisis there. So we really are very interested in what's going on, but we're not allowed to vote. So that's extremely frustrating. So we just set up this website, which will have a full list of candidates, constituencies. It's the real deal, except it's not actually a real vote. But we've had voting open for about 2 weeks now, so we're going to be publishing our results later on today.
And how does that help if the votes don't count?
It's just to raise awareness, really, of the issue. This is the first time this ever been happened, ever been attempted before. So it's getting quite a lot of publicity back home and also from people like yourselves. So we hope to raise awareness of the issue, and hopefully the new government, which is coming in, which will be coming in this weekend, will do something about this.
Now we have a little bit of time left, but John, how many people have you gotten participating in your online election so far?
We have 5,000, which is a very large poll in terms of it being an opinion poll. Usually opinion polls back home are done on a survey of about 1,000 people. So we've had 5,000 people today. We're hoping for maybe about another 500. So, we're pretty happy with that turnout, and hopefully it will highlight this issue.
John Byrne, co-creator of the site ballotbox.ie, a site for Irish expats so they can vote in their nation's election, which is being held today, although their votes don't count. John, thank you so much. We have a couple ways for you to look ahead to the Oscars this weekend. You can go to our website, to the blogs, and cast a vote in the ballot for who you think will win the best in film. But the Razzies are this weekend, too, celebrating what are the worst movies of the year. And we're asking you, what do you think they are? James Stephen writes, Gulliver's Travels with Jack Black. We saw it on Christmas Day, and I would have walked out if it hadn't been for the kids who loved it, because we all loved Jack Black, who was in School of Rock. Gulliver's Travels was unwatchable. And Zoran writes, if I took the time and expense to see it, how can I honestly vote in this category? Oh, wait, I got dragged to see Little Fockers. Let us know what you think is the worst movie, maybe the worst actor or actress of the year at 8778-MY-TAKE, or take our Oscars ballot at the Takeaway blog.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.